Let's talk a little bit about the use of chemotherapy in metastatic disease, and we'll focus on HER2 negative patients. So either ER positive or not, they've either had their hormones and now they're not responding to hormones, or they're ER negative, so they're going to get chemotherapy. How have you approached those patients in the past, and how has your approach been affected, if at all, since the data came out on bevacizumab?
So on to the second question first. The bevacizumab data, I actually have thought bevacizumab is a terrific drug, even when the first phase 3 study was reported. And in part, I think that was, we did participate in that phase 3 trial and had, you know, I personally have a patient who's still NED after receiving capecitabine bevacizumab. She had a complete response. I had to take her off drug for, she had a serious illness of an infectious type. And I had to take her off of drug, and she was NED, and I kept telling her that whenever her disease came back, we would restart, at that point, capecitabine, because bevacizumab was not available, and she hasn't recurred yet, and it's been 3 years.
Wow, that's amazing. Where was the disease?
It was cutaneous, actually. She had diffuse cutaneous disease that she had Ankyras disease extended, you know, sort of around to her posterior axillary line, up to her neck and down onto her abdomen and cross midline. It was quite impressive cutaneous disease that had progressed through quite a number of previous therapies.
That all went away when she got bevacizumab and capecitabine?
It did. It did. It's one of those small miracles. You know, that's always the usual anecdotal experience. But in reality, we had a positive experience participating in that study, had patients who did quite well and had good responses and good tolerance of the drugs. And as you know, even though that was a third-line regimen, there was a doubling of the response rate. So again, in the patients that you're wanting to use a more aggressive combination regimen because you want response, you can get that from even a third-line chemotherapy bevacizumab combination. When the ECOG 2100 study was published, the first-line randomization of weekly paclitaxel with bevacizumab, with or without bevacizumab, came out with a compelling improvement in time to disease progression and later a small but real survival advantage. You know, I think that changed the paradigm such that if I'm using a weekly paclitaxel regimen, I really do try to include bevacizumab. I think the patients in whom that is problematic are patients with hypertension, because that is one of the side effects of bevacizumab. And we have traditionally screened for CNS disease, asymptomatic CNS disease, when we're considering using bevacizumab, which is not my clinical practice normally. I have done that for bevacizumab. In reality, that caution may be a little more than we need to do, but it was born out of a couple of fairly devastating clinical complications early in the development of bevacizumab, such that all of the studies required CNS screening. As you know, the glioblastoma study that was presented at ASCO suggested really quite strong evidence of efficacy of bevacizumab in primary brain tumors, which certainly raises the question of whether we might see the same thing in CNS metastases. Obviously, it hasn't been answered and should be answered in a clinical protocol, but I think that particular caution may be something that we're a little less aggressive with and we may actually pursue it therapeutically in the future. But if I'm going to use weekly paclitaxel, then I strongly consider including bevacizumab unless there's a contraindication to do so.